Welcome to Manager Tools. Today, coaching is self-development, part one. The questions this cast answers are, what is the manager's role in coaching? What do I do when a direct resists coaching? And how can I motivate my directs to be coached?
Hey folks, this is Mark. You can't get away from me. Not only am I on the MT cast this week, I'm also doing the ad. This past week, while we were in Europe, delivering our public conferences in Prague, we were able to work with a client organization in Belgium who had been rescheduled multiple times due to COVID over the past 18 months. I think this is the longest we've ever had to reschedule thanks to COVID and governmental restrictions and so on. We're thrilled once again to be able to work with our client organizations on site or virtual, if that works best for your organization right now. Our client effective manager conferences, effective communicator conference, effective hiring managers are targeted to groups of 20 to 30 folks. And if you're thinking about sending folks to public conferences, that certainly works. But if you've got 20 to 30, you start getting cost benefits. I think the cost benefit analysis changes is like 12 or 13 or 15 people. And then the other thing you get is customization. We're going to want to talk to you about what's unique about your culture and what your organization does and so on. Particularly interesting, virtual events are great for teams that are spread out rather than doing in person, which typically is very costly due to travel logistics. So for more detail, contact Maggie on our team, which is maggie@manager-tools.com, or check out our website for the part that says for organizations. Thanks for listening to me for so long.
I'm really excited because today we have a guest. And you get to be a guest.
I love being a guest on my own show. Well, it's not my show anymore, is it?
No. Sarah's not here. So Mark and I are recording together.
Sarah is traveling back from Europe from our conference and a very successful client engagement with Sony Depth Sensing in Brussels.
Yeah. I think she's home. I think she's resting.
Yes. And jet lagging.
Yeah, probably. And so today we are going to focus on coaching. We're going to talk about coaching being self-development and what does that mean for our directs and what's involved and all those kinds of things. And really, I think the most important thing that we can say here is that coaching is self-development. And so, yes, managers play a very important role. And without a willing direct, you really...
Yeah, exactly.
It requires effort on the other person, on the directs.
Yeah, side. Enormous. 95%, right? I mean, right. Churchill once said, I'm sure it's not politically correct in these days, but anything Churchill says is worth re-listening to. He said the two hardest things in the world are climbing a ladder that's leaning towards you or kissing a lady leaning away from you. That's the equivalent of trying to coach somebody who's resistant. Now, there can be situations where they're resistant, but they have to comply. But we're going to talk specifically here about sanctions. People make the mistaken conclusion all the time that coaching is associated with sanctions, and actually, conceptually, it's not. And that helps managers because managers don't have to assume that their motivations are being questioned. If this doesn't go well, I'm not going to sanction you. That's not what this is about. And I think too many managers make that mistake. And if you're thinking that, the direct's thinking that, and if you're both thinking that, it's sitting like a cloud, just like Pigpen and Peanuts, right? With a cloud over his head, right?
All those scribbles. Yeah.
The other thing that I'm trying to do in part with this guidance is coaching is the most misunderstood of the four parts of the Trinity. One of the ones people kind of understand. Feedback, they get. They don't do it, but they get it. Delegation, people get it. They don't do it, but they get it. But coaching, people just don't understand. Far too many folks misdefine it. They think that it's small bits of teaching or training, or it's just guidance. Hey, next time do that differently or whatever. Mm-hmm. But actually, coaching, real coaching, takes time and lasts months. And like you said, it won't work if your direct isn't willing. And by willing, I don't just mean going along. And we're going to describe why that is. And that said, we managers, we're the organization. In your little neck of the woods, folks, you're the organization. So we managers must do everything we can to maximize our direct's chances to succeed.
So we're going to cover three things. First, coaching starts with trust. Second, your direct does the vast majority of the work. And finally, a reluctant direct makes success harder.
Right. We will talk about how to overcome some of the reluctance. But you have to be very careful about thinking that doing more of the work for the direct is a good thing, right? You'll say, well, I'll just help them more. Nah, we've tried that. Doesn't work. Yeah, good.
So coaching starts with trust. And if you've been listening, if you've been with us, we're recurring to our fundamental premise and, you know, most important kind of tenet around the manager and direct relationship and the fundamental leverage of all great managers, which is trust. If you haven't established trust with your direct, with whom you're considering coaching, it's going to require extraordinary effort. The most common example that we've talked about, right? We've covered this in our late stage coaching model cast. And we'll cover that in a minute. That's the most common example of a low trust coaching situation.
Yeah. And this is why we recommend managers don't roll out coaching. You don't start trying to coach your directs until literally more than half a year after you start doing one-on-ones, right? I mean, you have to invest. Now, you can try to do it any other way, but you're going against our recommendation and you're going to be trying to climb a ladder that's leaning towards you. It's going to be really, really hard.
In the same way that adult learning, which is a lot of what is involved with coaching,
right,
is difficult, building that trust. And so when I say it's difficult, I also mean it takes time.
It takes time.
Building trust takes time.
Yeah.
And of course, trust matters so much in coaching because the manager is going to do 5% of the work while the direct does 95%. And without that trust, how is that going to work out, right? Like that level, the discrepancy in level of effort is going to be tough. And because our role as managers is to help set the goal and create the metrics, keep track of the progress, support our direct, we are involved.
Right.
But that's still that 5% because 99% of the deliverables will be the direct's responsibility. That the person attached to who does this is them. If your direct doesn't trust you, it's really unlikely that they're going to put in their best efforts because they probably can't see what the positive outcome could be, right? It's like, why would I go through this process with you?
Yeah. Now, look, some of you heard that. Direct doesn't trust me. It's highly unlikely they're going to put their best work forward. That doesn't mean you're not obligated to offer to coach them and to try. Okay. It doesn't. Okay, just because your direct is not going to put their best effort in it, it doesn't mean that that doesn't obviate your responsibility to try to get improvement, and coaching is one way to do that. So don't use that as a cop-out, okay? Mm-hmm. Now look, the example of a low-trust direct or a resistant direct is especially true if you and your direct know or your direct feels even privately that the coaching that you're going to do for them is about improving some form of poor performance. And I know there are a bunch of people listening out there going, wait, what do you mean? Coaching is always about improving poor performance. And, and folks, that's another common misconception about coaching. Coaching is not at all only for improving substandard performance. It's not. You can coach your top performers in areas that might, in fact, be strengths for them. But perhaps they're good enough strengths, but not enough to get to the next level, maybe to get them a promotion to become your peer somewhere in the organization. And in fact, we've said many, many times over many, many hundreds, I think at some point we're going to get to 1,000 shows in manager tools alone. We've said it over and over again. When you first start coaching, start slowly, right? Don't just start coaching the week after you do one-on-ones. Wait the 6 months And by the way, folks, for those of you familiar with DISC, this is guidance coming from a guy who's a high D and a high I. My DISC score using Wiley is 7711, which the nickname of that score, that result on the DISC instrument is all go, no slow. Okay. You know, I'm full speed ahead on, you know, when I was leading troops, I was nearly Patton, and I was good at it. And I am telling you now, all the data I have, everything I know, what my head says, what my heart says, what my gut says, are all the same. Go slow. That we're going to use Ozan's rule. When it comes to people, fast is slow. If you try to rush it, it's going to get jinky. It's going to get messy, and it's not going to work. Okay. So we have said repeatedly, take the time to build trust. And then when you do roll out coaching, after you understand it, and we have plenty of podcasts, there's no way you could listen to all 20 or 30 of our coaching podcasts and not understand what your role is. After you do that, pick a top performer, pick one, and coach them on something that they're excited about. So you can learn the rhythm and the role and the cadence of coaching. And at times how hard it is, because you have to do it every week. It only takes 2 or 3 or 4 minutes a week during your one-on-one, but it takes it over and over and over again for 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And most people, look, in my experience, I mean, Kate, you may feel differently about this, but in my entire experience as a manager, the one thing I feel thematically from managers and talking to them, and even as a manager myself thinking about things, is people want a silver bullet. They want something to solve the problem. They don't want concerted effort. They don't want a long walk. They want that.
Now.
They want that. And like I say, there are no silver bullets in management because you're not managing werewolves. I'm just going to be as funny as the idea is that there could be a silver bullet. So coaching is not that. So it goes against people's grain that they just want to solve the problem. That's why you hear managers all the time. I just wish he'd do X. You know, if he just, he should do X, right? That's the idea that it should just be that for the person. So if you coach a couple of your top performers the first couple of times and get good at coaching, do it twice for 4 months, and now you're 8 months in on top of the 6 months. So yes, we're suggesting fully a year after you started rolling out one-on-ones, you're going to start actually coaching somebody who's, right, let's say, not below the minimum acceptable standard for the role they're in, but they're below the average. And they have a particular weakness, a performance, what's the word? One of their skills is below average. And you believe that impacting, improving that skill would make them average or above average. That has all kinds of benefits for them. And the problem that too many managers get into is the first time they're exposed to coaching, A, they haven't done one-on-ones, and B, they have to do late stage coaching. In fact, it's really sad, but most managers who aren't listening to manager tools, who don't know the fundamentals of management, don't understand the principles that so much of this is derived from, the first experience they have with coaching is late stage coaching. When all the risk is there, none of the trust is there, and they hate it. Well, you're hating the wrong thing. That's like hating football because you're trying to play basketball during the middle of a football game. You're right. Yeah, well, I hate football. It was horrible. I was trying to dribble and they kept running into me. Yeah, dude. Okay. Playing the wrong game there, dude. So you can coach your top performers, and we want you to. Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you've done this, if you've put in this work, and especially if you've been doing one-on-ones so that your trust is being built, it's being developed, that's where we're hoping you're engaging in coaching. If, though, you're not in that position and there's not a lot of trust, it's another instance where the horseman middleman test works.
One of my all-time favorites. This wins so many arguments in the field. People are like, well, my people won't do this because of this, rah, 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 rah. It's like, again, I just mentioned Peanuts. It's like the adults in the Peanuts TV shows.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown talks to his teacher and the teacher goes, rah, 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 right? And the manager goes, yeah, my people, rah, 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 rah. I'm like, okay, put yourself in their shoes. Well, right. I think I'm great. I said, I'm not talking about you managing you. I'm talking about you and your boss. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's different. That's totally different. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I love the middleman test.
Oh, I do too. I use it all the time and even outside of my management life.
Yes.
So if we think about the middleman test in this context, we're asking ourselves, what if you didn't trust your boss and she was going to coach you?
Yeah.
Sure, you'd probably comply.
I'm going to say that different. What if you yourself, not your directs, didn't trust your boss? Put mm-hmm. yourself in the mind of a direct. That's what the middleman test is all about. We all got bosses, right?
Mm-hmm. So you swap your hat. You think of yourself. What if your boss, I almost want to say inflicted coaching on you without trust involved? And when we think of it that way, it's really easy for me to imagine, yeah, I'll go along with this. And then in the back of my mind, like,
yeah, exactly.
You don't feel that's something that you should commit to. So we end up with compliance and okay, there's, compliance isn't the end of the world, but we know that that's not what we're looking for. We know that commitment is the thing that gets us to greatness.
Yeah.
Especially when you're the person who has to do the work, if you're the direct.
Right.
And the middleman test is just another way for us to prove that our directs are a lot less likely to commit if they don't have trust. In the same way that's how we would behave.
And here's the way I like to think about coaching. I want you to look at each of your directs and think about 100% of their work getting done in 100% of their time. Now you might say, well, they're not getting 100% of their work done. Dude, you're missing the point, okay? They get whatever work they're getting done during 100% of the time they spend. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's not 100% of what you think, forget about that for a minute. We're doing a very numerical analysis, not an ethical analysis. So they're getting 100% of their work done and 100% of their time. What coaching says is I want you to do 100% of your work in 95% of your time so you can have 5% left over to focus on coaching. Now, look, there are a lot of people whose natural tendency is to say, I can't do that. Now, that's false, but they believe it. And there are plenty of false beliefs in the world. In fact, I think false beliefs is what caused the earth to spin on its axis sometimes. But you're not going to get somebody who doesn't want to put 100% of their work, figure out ways to get 100% of their work done in 95% of their time to a similar level of quality. You're not going to get them to agree to spend 5% on something new or something that's risky or something that they have fear of failure about. If they're not committed. Mm-hmm. And again, as you said, trust comes from commit. Hey folks, last ad I mentioned conferences. We have a conference coming up October 12th and 13th in Denver, lovely Denver, Colorado, the Mile High City. We have an in-person effective manager and effective communicator conference pairing. October 12th is the effective manager. October 13th is the effective communicator. We encourage you to come. In-person events are always talked about as being better than virtual. Virtual is useful, valuable, necessary in some cases, but the in-person events are priceless. And I think we're the only management training firm that has people stay after at the end of the day to ask more questions because they're so fired up. And that's our standard, that we can convince you to want to stick around and ask more questions because it was so valuable and energizing as well. So Denver. October 12th and 13th. Come to the website, sign up. Thanks, folks. Now, look, I want to talk here specifically about a particular case, about late-stage coaching, because it looms large over all the coaching engagements. In fact, I really do think that I mentioned that people say of coaching as being teaching or training or, a form of like super feedback or something. Or let's sit down and discuss with our direct every single time they make a mistake. Oh, Harvard Business Review and Wall Street Journal interviews all the time. They're like, oh, every time you want to have a feedback thing, you need to give your direct a chance to be heard. It's all about conversation and giving them a platform in which to air their concerns. No, believe me, these people have never run an organization. They're sitting back in their ivory tower saying, yes, we want to apply all kinds of justice-driven ideas into the organizational world, and that's not effective. So the other thing that I would say that a lot of managers think coaching is what you do when one of your directs is about to be fired and HR has said you need to coach them so we can have a lot of data so that when we get sued, if we get sued, we can prove to the court that it was a righteous termination.
Proof.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, don't get me started. So late stage coaching is what most managers know of a coaching situation. Your direct must improve, and they know failure to improve will likely result in termination or significant sanctions. If you're new to management, you might assume that the fear of firing for performance would motivate anybody. But the data doesn't actually support that. There are plenty of people who know that they're going into late stage coaching, and they just don't care. Now, the fact is, privately, most of us understand this because we have all kinds of cognitive dissonance in our own lives. I know I need to do that, and I'm not doing it. There's a great sort of wry, ironic quote which says, the great joy in life is not having nothing to do. It's having something to do and not doing it. Right? Sort of like you're saying, piss off to the world. Okay, but the reason, usually, that someone is in late stage coaching is that the direct has been struggling for an extended period. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of managers don't know what to do. They've never been told. The organization doesn't teach, doesn't train, doesn't do whatever. And this is made worse by poor or non-existent metrics, right? That means the organization doesn't have convincing records of the direct's failure to perform. The manager knows, the direct knows, everybody knows. Because so many managers fail to give negative feedback, though, the direct is often lulled in believing that they're not struggling. Or at least if I was really struggling enough that my job was at risk, somebody would tell me, surely. In fact, if you apply the middleman test to that, you'd say, yeah, my boss should be telling me I'm at risk if I am.
Yeah, a heads up.
Yeah. Yeah. So when late stage coaching begins, for the vast majority of managers, the sudden use of metrics, what? I'm going to have to report on every single thing I do. It's like micromanaging, right? Now you're micromanaging me. Why would you do that, right? And you mentioned proof. This is, metrics get put in place, which that's included in coaching, guys, in the same way that profit is part of your company and pay raises are part of your company and forced rankings are part of your performance reviews. There's billions of metrics, right? Budgets are a form of metric, but then we add on top of all that stress, the lawyers from HR insisting, as we said earlier, on proof. And basically, whatever trust you might have had, and if you started out with a low amount, you're now in deficit. There's now active distrust because whatever trust you might have had with your direct has been eroded significantly.
Absolutely. It's almost hard to imagine how it could not.
Right. Yeah, agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're going to lead, that's what coaching is.
Right.
It leading is
exactly
your direct
what it is.
To better performance.
Yeah.
They're going to have to trust you in order for you to lead.
By the way, I just want to interrupt real quick. I'll let you continue the thought. But one of the greatest definitions I ever heard of leadership was, or what a leader is, was Peter Drucker's. You know what a leader is? Somebody who has followers. Now, what Drucker is so good at doing is implying another 500 paragraphs to support that. So ask yourself, folks, apply the middleman test. Who are you going to follow? You're going to follow somebody you don't trust? No.
No.
That statement by Peter Drucker is what got me working on the issue of why one-on-ones worked and mm-hmm. asking the right questions and discovering it was all about trust. Sorry, I just had to interject there. I like throwing around Peter Drucker stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always beneficial. Always.
He's smart.
Always educational.
Yes.
So if we think about that quote, if we think about what it takes to lead, we assume that someone has to trust they have to trust you in order to follow you. And so we really can't ever and shouldn't ever talk about coaching without making that link.
Right.
And assuming that the foundation of right. this process would be trust.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. I think if I asked the average manager on a scale of 1 to 10, how much does this direct? Everybody wants to say, how much do all your directs trust you? I don't care about the average score. I care about the individual scores, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, the poor performers always have low trust and, you know, you should be working to, we recommend, sorry, I hate the word should in management. We recommend you work hard on everybody's trust, and you cannot build trust with a team. You can only build trust with individuals. Mm-hmm. And that aggregate score is a dumb score. I think too many managers, when the direct says 3, the manager says 6.
Yeah.
We've actually done that. We've actually repeated that study before. The first time we ever did it, it was like 700 or 800 managers, and maybe it was 600. No, it was more than that. It might have been 1,000 or more. We asked the managers on a scale of 1 to 10, how much your directs trust you, and the manager said 6.9, and their direct said 3.1. Oh. I mean, it was like, oh, brutal. Right.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then we did one-on-ones and the trust score changed. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm concerned, trust is such a lever, what you were saying about earlier, that's reason enough.
Yeah.
To do it separate from the deliverables updates, the strategy discussions, the tactics, the communication, the repetitiveness of it, the reliability of it, all that stuff. No, it's the trust score that really matters.
Or, and separate from being a kind, thoughtful person to the other people that you work with. You know, you spend 8 hours a day all driving towards the same goal and we don't communicate.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kate, I don't think you understand what it's like to be a manager in a large organization. I don't think you understand. I just don't have time to spend a half an hour with each of my directs once a week. I don't.
No, that's tough. I get it. I hear so often.
I'm a very busy person.
So busy. Like, okay, first of all.
Like the guy with the hat. Like the guy with the hat in Frosty the Snowman. Busy, busy, busy.
If everyone was as busy as they say that they are, oh my God. Candy Crush would not exist.
Right.
Also, Game of Thrones. Not that I'm sassing Game of Thrones.
No. Don't do that.
Except that it is roughly 1,000 hours of television.
Yeah. And add to that. I've said it. How many times have I said it on air? Sitting in first class, the back row of first class on an airplane for many years, American Airlines flight 6B, seat 6B, walking down the aisle toward the back. It's the last seat on the right in first class. It allows me to recline my seat even during takeoff. It puts my coat right behind me so that I don't have to rely on a forgetful flight attendant to give it to me. And I could see 3/4 of the screens, and they're all doing something other than work.
Yeah.
Like, dude, you're not busy, busy, busy. If you're watching Game of Thrones or watching The Office or playing Candy Crush on your laptop or on your phone when you're flying in the middle of the work week, Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Yeah. We'll be back next week with more on this topic.